As we noted last week, when we were talking about the instrument and the introduction of instruments into the worship of the church, the periodicals of that day played a large role in whether or not those instruments would be accepted. We talked about three last week that were major periodicals: the American Christian Review that Ben Franklin published from Texas, the Christian Standard that Isaac Herrick published from Cincinnati, the Gospel Advocate that was published by David Lipscomb out of Nashville. Now, prior to that, the two major journals that were a part of the Restoration Movement were the Christian Baptist and the Millennial Harbinger, both of which were published by Alexander Campbell. The second journal was called The Evangelist. It was published by Walter Scott. Now, a lot of these journals have been gathered into bound volumes, and they're republished. I don't know where they're available on the internet in bound volumes, but you can purchase them. And it's fascinating reading to read through those journals. The two journals that I had complete copies of the Christian Baptist and the Evangelist that Walter Scott published. And it's fascinating to read them. They're written on a much more elevated level of writing than what you commonly read in the newspapers today. Reading these journals is a little bit hard. You have to really work to follow what's going on in these journals. But they've had, at times, benefits for the Restoration Movement. And at times, they have been terribly detrimental. They have been divisive. And the disadvantages of these journals prompted W.T. Moore to make this statement about the journals. He said, "The disciples of Christ do not have bishops. They have editors." And I think as we go through this discussion of the journals and the kind of the role that they played in the maturing of the Restoration Movement, you'll come to understand a little bit about what W.T. Moore was talking about. Good friend of mine who preached at Fairview when I was growing up said, "We don't write to be understood. We write so that we will not be misunderstood." And you may see that play out in this as well. There were some important appendages. That's not a real good word, but I couldn't think of a better word to put in there, that kind of attached themselves to the church. And they became an integral part of the movement. The first was, well, not the first, but one was cooperative meetings, where churches in an area would send a representative to a particular city, and they would meet together, and they would try to determine some way to respond to whatever was happening at the moment. There were Bible schools and Bible chairs. And if you read the material that I sent you, you know, hang on to that, because we'll get to that. We'll talk about the influence that the Bible schools had. But tonight I want to start by talking about the influence of religious journals. Now, I said that these things began to exercise considerable influence in the Restoration movement. The cooperative meetings eventually evolved into missionary societies. The Bible schools and the Bible chairs became universities. And the religious journals began to imitate denominational hierarchies. So, and when I say denominational hierarchies, I'm talking about the system that we encountered way back when we were talking about the Presbyterians. You had the presbytery, that was a group of local congregations, and then you had the synod, that was over the number of presbyteries that were in a region, and then you had the General Assembly, and that was over the entire country. I don't think the Presbyterians ever got to the point where they had anything that was bigger than the General Assembly. But we're going to talk about these journals in terms of really six ideas, and we may only get through the first one tonight because it's really the longest. We're going to talk about the scriptural justification that was offered for the publication of these journals. We're going to talk a little bit about the nature of the Restoration journals. We're going to talk about the relationship that came to exist between the journals and the church. We're going to talk some about the contributions that these journals made to the development of the Restoration movement. And we'll talk about some dangers that the journals posed to the movement. And then finally, we're going to talk about an idea that surrounds the way that churches sought to control these journals. One of the things that, as we go through this, that I want you to notice is the similarity that exists between these journals that were published in the 1880s and continue to be published even today, and the movement that we see in our country, at least, to have blogs and live stream videos and Zoom worship, where we're impacting a lot of people with the things that we say. So we'll talk a little bit more specifically about that, that these issues that the journals raised are issues that we're still dealing with. There's still the things that we have to worry about. Even today, we don't worry too much about churches wanting to have a covenant, and you have to sign the covenant when you become a part of the, for instance, the Coburg Road Church of Christ. You'd have the Coburg Road Church of Christ covenant. We don't have too much of that. Some denominational groups still do, but by and large, in the Restoration movement and the churches that are associated with it, the Disciples of Christ, the Christian churches, the Church of Christ, even the United Christian Church, you don't see very much of the covenant idea, but you still see these ideas playing out in our contemporary society. So let's think of first about the scriptural justification that was given for the publication of these journals. I think it goes without saying that there are no biblical examples of Christians ever editing and publishing or distributing a religious journal. Essentially a magazine. You also don't find any biblical examples of Christians using radio or television or blogs or the Zoom platform or live stream platforms to reach beyond the local congregation with the written or the spoken word. Now, when the journals were proliferating, everything had to be done by the written word. You would put together a journal and it would be mailed to a subscription list. Many of them were twice a month. Sometimes they were monthly. But everything back then was basically written. You didn't have the abilities that we have today. And when you think about preparing and editing and publishing a journal, because of the nature of the publication business, that was pretty expensive back then. The cost for desktop publishing is coming down now. I can publish material pretty quickly and easily, and I don't have to go through the expenses that are involved in typesetting and printing. I don't even have to buy paper. I don't have to pay for postage. All those kinds of things. We've made it much easier for us to be involved in this kind of thing. But back then, this was, for the most part, a fairly expensive undertaking. So the fact is that even though there weren't biblical examples of this, many people offered the idea that the gospel can still be taught, whether by word or by epistle. So the Apostle Paul, for instance, could go to a city and he could preach, or he could write a letter to the Christians in that city. And either one of those was a methodology that they used and used extensively in the New Testament time period. Can I get somebody to read 2 Thessalonians? The second chapter, and you'll kind of see what I'm talking about here. 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, and we can just look at verse 15 because that makes the point.
So then, brethren, stand firm and hold to the traditions which you were taught, whether by word of mouth or by letter from us.
Okay. So that makes a point, and it's very reasonable to assume that the gospel can be taught either by word of mouth or by a letter. The second point that they made, and it does make sense to me, although I'm not well versed in the techniques that folks use at when they try to make a determination like this. But many have concluded that the Gospel of Luke was written to somebody named Theophilus. And because of the way that the Gospel of Luke is written, they've concluded that Theophilus might not have been a Christian at the time that Luke wrote him his gospel. So it was essentially a letter that was written down, or a treatise that was written down, And it was written down for the purpose of sending it to Theophilus, just like the book of Acts was also sent to Theophilus. I don't know whether that's true or not. Luke, the first chapter, does specify Theophilus without specifying exactly whether he was a Christian at the time that Luke wrote to him. But whether he was a Christian or not, we do know pretty clearly that Christians, or at least the apostles, were given the responsibility of preaching the gospel to the whole world and then baptizing them. Now, that necessitates that they were going to preach to them when they were not Christians. So this idea that we could put together a journal and we could publish it for the benefit of people that are not Christians makes complete sense to me. And you can see that they, not only did they talk about justifying the words, the spoken word or the letter, they also talked about whether it could be sent to people that were not Christians. Now, most of the letters in the New Testament were written to Christians. And we can be fairly confident of that because of the way that the letters are addressed. And we've talked about that on other occasions. Many times, a letter would have been written to a church where the author of the letter had already spent some time preaching in person. And we're familiar with those kinds of examples. The Apostle Paul wrote the Corinthian letter to the Corinthians, and we know that he had spent time there in Corinth and may have been involved in the earliest days of the church there in Corinth. So that makes some sense that the author of the material already had a relationship with the Christians in a particular place, and he wrote a letter back to them. I find pretty good indication, at least in my mind, that some of the letters, at least, were written to people that the author of the letter may not have known personally. But it's more of a general letter that the Apostle James, for instance, is writing to inform people in a particular place or in a particular region or a group of people about the things of the gospel. Can somebody read James 1 at verse 1?
James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings.
Okay. Does this sound to you like James knew these people, or is he introducing himself to them and writing them this treatise?
I don't know. I don't know.
I guess the question, it seems reasonable to me that James is sending this to people that he probably had never met. So again, that's not an unreasonable conclusion to draw from the way that this is written. And they, of course, they had to say, well, we can write letters to the people we know. We can write letters to people that we don't know, just letters for general circulation. And that's what the journals were, just for general circulation. And we also know that the letters that were written by the authors that are in the New Testament were often circulated beyond the people to whom the letter was specifically addressed. Can somebody read 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 2?
To the church of God, which is at Corinth, to those who have been sanctified in Christ Jesus, saints by calling, with all who in every place call on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, their Lord and ours.
Okay, so again, my conclusion when I read something like this is that Paul was writing specifically to the Corinthians, and he knew that this would be read in other places. Now, there are cases where the Apostle Paul gave explicit instructions. The letter that I sent to this person, have it read in this church as well. I would argue that maybe in that case, Paul was addressing those two churches. But this seems to be a case of the apostle saying, I'm writing to the Corinthians and to everybody else that's going to read this letter. So it makes sense that you would prepare a journal or a magazine that contained the gospel, sermons, letters, discussions, and that it would be distributed to people that were Christians, maybe to people that weren't Christians, to specific places or to places where it went kind of by accident. Those justifications seem to make sense to everybody. Well, this was the basis on which these journals were undertaken. Now, it's also important to say that whether it was written or it was spoken, the gospel, the underlying core message had to be the same. It wasn't as if you could say one thing and write something else. Now, there were people who wrote under pseudonyms or assumed names. One of those assumed names was a fellow by the name of Christophilus. And he wrote a lot of articles in the Christian Baptist. I don't know exactly who that was. People have tried to identify it as one person or another. I'm not sure that I could, but they sometimes wrote under assumed names. Now, the danger when you have someone writing anonymously is that they just become a bomb thrower. We see this a lot when we're talking about stuff that appears on the internet. People will say things in posts that they would never say to somebody's face. And that was never intended to be a part of the whole publication effort. Whatever you said in person was what you said in your letters or in your writings. Can somebody read Acts 15? This makes the point that in the early church, they recognized just how important this concept was, that you don't get to write things that you wouldn't say to somebody's face. And I get the impression that that was one of the problems that arose in Corinth. You had a lot of people that were saying things kind of behind Paul's back that they wouldn't say to his face. Well, let's look at Acts 15 at verse 23 beginning and read down through verse 27. Now, to set the stage, this is what happened after some folks went from Jerusalem down to Antioch. And they began teaching some things, well, really teaching circumcision, and saying, well, the apostles back in Jerusalem sent us out to teach this. And the church in Antioch said, whoa, wait a minute. We need to go find out from the apostles if they really sent you out to teach this. So this is what the apostles responded. Yeah, go ahead, Lenny. Did you have a question?
It's led by them. No, I'm reading Acts. Acts 15:23 beginning. And they sent this letter by them, the apostles and the brethren who are elders, to the brethren in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia, who are from the Gentiles, greetings. Since we have heard that some of our number to whom we gave no instruction have disturbed you with their words, unsettling your souls, it seemed good to us, having become of one mind, to select men to send to you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul, men who have risked their lives for the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, we have sent Judas and Silas, who themselves will also report the same things by word of mouth.
Okay. So, sometimes the written material was clearer, and sometimes word of mouth was clearer. There's a lot to be said for face-to-face communication. You can't see a lot of what's going on when you can't see someone's face and you don't know what they're doing. About the only thing we can do when we send an email or a letter or a text or something like that is we type in all caps, and that means I'm yelling. Well, some people just type in all caps all the time. So it's hard. when you have only written material to know exactly what people were intending to say. But whether written or spoken, the underlying message should have been the same. Does that make sense to everybody? I think that's a really important consideration, because if you think that the political discourse and the discourse within churches can sometimes become confrontational today, you ought to go back and read what those guys wrote. They were almost mean to each other. I know in the political arena, it was harsh. Okay. One other idea, and this is something that's important, I think, was that uninspired men, these writers and editors, Alexander Campbell, Walter Scott, Ben Franklin, Isaac Eric, David Lipscomb, any of these guys, uninspired men, could also be expected to write and speak. In other words, we're not restricted to simply repeating what an inspired man wrote down. But we can reason on it, and we can offer a commentary on what they have written. Now, when the Apostle Paul worked with Timothy, it was pretty clear that he expected Timothy to go out and continue to preach, just like he personally had been preaching. I am of the opinion that the Apostle Paul laid his hands on Timothy and imparted to him a measure of the Spirit so that Timothy was able to perform miracles. He was able to do things that were a manifestation of the fact that he had the Spirit. And we could talk about that, but, that's my conclusion from what I read. However, my conclusion also would be that Timothy, if the apostle did lay his hands on Timothy and impart to him the ability to work miracles, that Timothy could not have laid his hands on someone and imparted that ability to work miracles. So the ability to lay their hands on someone died when the apostles died. But Timothy was expected not only to preach as an inspired person, I think, he was also expected to recruit uninspired men who would also teach. I mean, that's the justification for me or Lenny or Ron or Ted or Dean or anybody to teach. Can somebody read 2 Timothy 2 at verse 2?
and the things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also.
Okay. So, inspired men, of course, we understand that they were given the responsibility to teach. That included people who were not apostles. And other people were given the responsibility to teach as well. So the justification behind publishing these journals makes a lot of sense to me. We'll talk a little bit more about how things kind of got sideways a little bit, but it does appear to be reasonable to say that these journals and like efforts are biblically warranted. So that raises a lot of questions. Can the local church support a man so that that man can preach beyond the confines of the local church? Because these journals were generally intended to be distributed across, well, really, the United States, wherever there was reliable postal service. These journals were intended to be mailed across the nation. And in like manner, today, we don't generally have as many journals as they had back then in terms of printed journals, but we do have a lot of blogs, and we do have, well, we do Zoom presentations, and our Zoom presentations reach beyond the confines of the local church here at Coburg Road.
Dean?
Yeah.
I can remember back when I was a young man. My dad wrote for several articles for the Gospel Guardian and the Gospel Advocate. Back in his day, back in the late 40s, early 50s, they had a controversy over this, sponsoring churches, with the primary one being the church in Abilene, Texas, and how the money was distributed and so forth. They also had a controversy over the orphans' homes, and controversies that are going on to this day, and the church is split to a great degree because of them. But this was a way to get a lot of the inside and a lot of the beliefs and so forth like that out there across the country.
That's true. So could Coburg Road pay me to publish a blog? Or, which is the way we would probably do it today. It would be publishing a blog or publishing material that could be distributed using the internet to facilitate distribution. Go ahead, Carol.
Well, we've had different times where we tried to do radio programs, and that's the same sort of thing. It's just a different format.
Yes, yes. Radio, TV. TV is a real expensive medium. Radio is a lot cheaper, but there has been some controversy over a radio program that originated at the Highland Park Church in Texas that went across the country. And there was some question about whether Highland Park ought to be sponsoring or asking other churches to join in sponsoring this radio program. Television, particularly if it's well done, is an incredibly expensive medium. And, you know, and we've seen how that can get people into trouble with the, what was the preacher that just shot himself in the foot? Jimmy Swaggart was one. Tammy Faye and Bob Baker, they had the Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN, to produce high quality television is an expensive proposition. And they solicited funds from other people to help them do that. So that's kind of the first question. Can the church support a man to blog or preach? Now, the church here supports me so that I can teach, so that I can preach. I have not been involved in blogging, really, on any kind of scale. I have been involved in preparing material that goes out over our Zoom connection, and we have a lot of folks that get this Zoom broadcast that are not members here at Coburg Grove. I have at times done radio broadcasts. We did a radio broadcast when I was in Brookings on the local radio station. Wasn't terribly expensive. I've done it in Cottage Grove when I was invited to come up to Cottage Grove and be on their radio program. I've even done television. And I could tell you horror stories about all of the mistakes that we made when we were producing our own television program. That was on a local station in Cerritos, California. And so we did it. It can be done. It's just terribly expensive. Okay. Now, here's the associated question. If the local church can pay a man to publish, does the local eldership exercise oversight over the journal or the blog or the TV show or the radio program or Zoom?
Yes, and if the person doing the speaking isn't speaking what the elders agree with, then the elders have a chance to talk to him and take their name off of it and take his name off if he won't change. And if he does change, then he needs to make the notification, just like any other Christian, that, okay, I was wrong on this.
Okay. That would be one way of exercising control.
If you have if this blog or journal or whatever you want to call it is controlled or is sponsored by a local church, then the elders have authority over that and have that responsibility to oversee that. If the funds being used to support that blog are done so by the members of that congregation, Then we would have to oversee that, I think.
Okay. Now this all gets to be, you know, sounds on one level really simple, but it's not quite as simple as we might think. When I was teaching at EWU at Eastern Washington University, I was faculty member at Eastern Washington. I had an office on the campus. I had a computer that was provided to me by the university. I wrote a book, and that book was published. I thought I was the one that was responsible for what was in the book. The university said, no, we are. So we get the money that the book generates. When I left Eastern Washington University, I thought, well, I'll take all of my class material with me that I've prepared, that I taught in my classes at Eastern Washington University. And they said, no, 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 that material belongs to the university. It does not belong to you. And they said, the reason it belongs to the university is we gave you office space, we gave you a computer, and that's what you use to prepare the book and the material that you used in your classes. Now, that seemed totally unreasonable to me at the time, and whatever I wrote has never been a bestseller, so it's not like I would have gotten fabulously wealthy over anything that I wrote or anything like that. But the church gives me an office. They make this office available to me. They make the internet connection available to me. I have my computer, but the material that I write, does that belong to the church or does it belong to me? When I leave, do I leave it all here or do I take it all with me? I'm not sure how I would answer those questions.
I suppose we've got two grown adults here, a preacher and the elders, and you talk about it ahead of time and decide. I know Jerry Bassett wrote his own book and paid for the own publishing and stuff. And I'm sure he used the office or did it all at home. But some businesses say, well, you're on the payroll. Doesn't matter whether you're at work or not. We have you during this time period. Any ideas you have, that's mine. But the eldership is not a dictatorial situation like that. And so long as it's your name and you're not printing it for the congregation, the congregation elders have the right to say, well, it's okay to do it by yourself.
Okay. Now, that's the approach that we've taken. Would it be reasonable for me to solicit contributions from another church to support the technology that we use to put out Zoom? Now, right now, our technology outlay has been really pretty manageable. We've spent, Lenny, do either one of you remember exactly how much we've spent? It's less than $3,000.
I believe you're correct. I think Zoom is costing us almost $15 a month. And then with the equipment we purchased, the monitors and computers, we have about $2,500 altogether.
Okay. So is it reasonable for me to solicit funds from another church to help facilitate doing Zoom? would it be reasonable for me to solicit funds from individuals so that we could put together our Zoom broadcast? Now, we've never had to do that. We've never had to face those questions. But that's because Zoom or blogging is a fairly inexpensive way to publish material. Now we could upgrade Zoom a lot. We could have a studio here at the building that would enable us to do some things that we can't do. And our Zoom presentation would look better, probably. If we were publishing a journal, we could have the publication material that would enable us to have slick paper with color separation photos, and you know, the bulletin that we publish here, we do on a desktop computer. Everything is done in-house. It's Xeroxed. It doesn't look as nice as it would if we had it offset printed, but having it offset printed is more expensive, and we've chosen not to do that. Now, here's what I know. If I'm sending it beyond the confines of this local church, then it becomes more important that it's a really slick looking presentation. And all of those things cost money. And when they start costing money, we start looking for ways to subsidize the expense. So if the church, if in the context of my employment here, I wrote material that I decided to gather together into some sort of book form and make it available to other people and sell it to them, what happens to the money? Is that the church being in a business? Is it me being in a business? Or should I make that material available to them for free? Now, it must be said, that has always been my approach. If I prepare material that I prepare at the behest of the church here, for which the elders make available to me certain technology and time and an office and all of those things, I don't ever sell that. I never would. Probably couldn't if I tried, but I never sell it. I give it away for free. And I know some preachers who have that philosophy. I know some preachers who have another philosophy that says, I can sell this material.
Dean?
Yeah.
I believe that Jerry Bassett did a little bit of both. He provided free copies for the congregation, but he sold it to other people. And I'm sure that was an agreement that he made with. I mean, as the Bible says, before you go to battle, count the cost. I mean, you don't want to write this book and then find out the elders say no.
That's true. That's true.
I think I kind of got lost through all of the examples, but I almost think, and I know that you're trying to make a point with this restoration, but I think the whole discussion kind of misses the point of what our purpose is. I think if you're a preacher and your purpose is to make money selling a book, then you probably should be a writer and not a preacher. I think that Jerry Bassett wrote books out of his passion for the gospel. And I know that he spent the bulk of his time, whether at the building studying or at his home studying, teaching the gospel. And that the cost of those books and those things at him, or the study lessons that his brother wrote, the cost was really to cover the cost, so that he wasn't incurring a debt while he was giving people an opportunity to learn something new. You know, our goal at Coburg Road Church of Christ is to work in this local area. Our focus with Zoom was so that our shut-ins, people that couldn't be a part of Zoom, could participate. Now, if it benefits other people that are not part of our congregation and they choose to be part of Zoom, then that's awesome. But we didn't set Zoom up. We're not in the business of making money. And I think that I know for myself that if we got into the business of making money, that I personally would leave, because I don't think that that's our focus. If our focus, like Paul says, you know, he talks to the Corinthians and he said, I could be charging you money, but I don't. You know, if I'm able to preach, then far be it from me not to preach. I'm obligated to preach if I'm able. He wasn't in it for the money. And I think that there's a huge, huge lesson to be learned in that. You know, so I have a hard time with even equating the examples to us in person, because I just don't see that that's really the focus of the church or the preacher. You know, if you're in it for the money, then you're probably in it for the wrong reasons, and maybe and I'm not saying that's what you're doing. I just have been listening to all this and trying to put it all together, and I'm struggling with the examples, I guess.
Well, Dean, the point that I'm trying to make is a lot of times it starts out, like you say, with a goal that everybody supports, and then it gets a little bit sideways. And it's when it gets a little bit sideways with that goal, then is when it starts to have a dangerous impact on churches.
Okay. And I was hoping that was where you were going with it, but I was just confused with the direction that we were heading, but that makes it a lot more clear for me. Thank you.
Yeah. And one of the things that we'll talk about when we talk about the nature of these journals is they were expensive. And because they were expensive, the publishers started to solicit funds from churches. They didn't necessarily start by soliciting funds from churches. What they said is, why doesn't the church buy a subscription to this journal for all of its members? And that'll be income for us from subscriptions, and we can keep the thing going. Or sometimes they said, well, the church can't really support a business like that, but the church could buy advertising in the journal and support the journal that way. Or we could have a directory, and the church pays a monthly fee to be listed in the directory. So it's where we get a little bit sideways. And then if the church says, well, we'd like to be listed in the directory, and the editor says, you can't be, because for some reason I disagree with something that's being taught there. Okay. Then you have an editor deciding who is an acceptable church and who is not an acceptable church. And then it becomes even more problematic. Okay, let me just pose one more question, and it's this. Should any organization or individual effort intrude into the church's responsibility to spread the gospel? And I'll leave it with you there. And you guys can think about that, and we'll continue the discussion next week. But I ask these questions because it makes us think about, like Dean has pointed out, how good things sometimes go a little bit bad. And when it goes a little bit bad, it can be really divisive.